Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. True stories of the mob skimming from the Las Vegas casinos in the 1970s. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. Highly sought after speaker for college, corporate, and service organization programs. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. We must pay the studio time and Freedom of Information Act requests that we filed with the federal government. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Please subscribe to this podcast and review the show. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome, folks. Welcome back to the Gangland Wire Crime Stories. We're down here in the deep, dark confines of Studio 4 with my friend, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Did you guys know out there that he has the most interesting independent music in the Midwest? It's an independent radio show every Monday night. Just go to www.bigdumbfunshow.com and tune in, and you'll figure out how to listen to his archives and listen to him live on Monday nights.
And watch us on Periscope now.
He's got an interesting thing going. If you haven't heard of Periscope, he's going to start going around and raising the Periscope up for you folks at local clubs.
I've already done it. I was at the Royals game. I was out at First Friday here in Kansas City. Before that, on Friday of last week, National Donut Day.
Cool.
I don't know when you're listening to this podcast, but nonetheless, we're on Periscope. I wanted to get Gary Jenkins to do a Gangland Wire True Crime Stories on Periscope.
That would be interesting.
He's a little shy to show his face with some of these stories, though, because, you know, they might upset some people.
Well, I've heard we've upset some people recently, but I think...
Nobody in the Klan, I hope.
Nobody in the Klan. I haven't got that one out yet.
Yeah,
so.
I know. I'm kind of glad, because there was there was part of it that I wanted to come back and talk to you about, maybe cutting out.
Okay,
The part where you're blindfolded, do you remember that? You were blindfolded when your friend was taking you to where he lived.
Oh, yeah, right. And
so you have no idea where he lives.
No, I
couldn't
don't.
Tell you at all.
No, I don't. I don't. I don't know where he lives. I don't know where his office is. I kind of know where his office is, but I absolutely have no idea where he lives. That is a friend of mine who, of all things, he runs a private, off-the-books intelligence unit, so to speak, and he gathers information on right-wing extremist groups like the Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazi Party and the Nationalist Socialist Party and other groups like that. He is a recognized expert on that, but he does keep a low profile.
Yeah. Well, now, while he does, they don't. Would you ever consider having a podcast conversation with any of those guys? Do you think they would come into the studio to expound their point of view? Or?
Well, they probably would. If you remember that, we played a little clip from this one right-wing racist TV show from the White Aryan Resistance called Race and Reason. And the problem with talking to those guys, Aaron, is when they start talking, they just go on a rant. You don't have a back-and-forth conversation. It's a one-sided rant, and then finally you get them to shut up. And so I don't think it would be a very entertaining show for our folks out there. Anyhow, so let's carry on. I was a sergeant over the SWAT team for 2 years. I'm going to have to tell some SWAT stories one of these nights, but Tonight, I'm going to tell a story about, it's kind of periphery about the mob in Kansas City. If you remember, if you've seen my movie, Gangland Wire, it starts off with a entertainment district called the River Key, just north of downtown, and there was a lot of clubs down there, and a lot of strip clubs wanted to move in down there in the Key area. There was a man named Fred Bonadonna who resisted that. And Fred, when he resisted that, his dad was a member of the local mafia. One of the local mob chieftains, a guy named Willie the Rat Camisano, put pressure on Freddie's dad, David, to tell Freddie, you need to come into line and help us get these strip clubs put in down in the River Key area. And it was all singles bars back in the 70s, a really nice area and kind of a family area during the day and kind of swinging singles for young professionals at night, and they didn't really need the strip clubs.
No strip clubs there beforehand.
And Freddie had resisted it. He had a good contact on the city council, and the city councilman was hip to the fact that all these mob associates wanted to put their strip clubs down there because there was a lot of foot traffic, and they figured they could make money.
Well, they would have to file some forms and documents and stuff with the city to even be allowed to do it.
Correct. And that's where it came in with Fred. Freddie got his friend and the city councilman, a man named Bob Hernandez, to then put some pressure on liquor control to not let the strip clubs move down. Now, they found a way around it. Politically, they found a way around it. There was a politically appointed liquor control board during that time, and I can't say they got to these guys, but all of a sudden, the strip club's owners' license applications got approved by this politically appointed board, and they started moving down there. And the whole thing blew up. There was problems. A club blew up, and the headlines hit the paper, and people just quit coming down there, absolutely stopped coming down there.
How long after they opened their strip clubs did that happen?
Oh, it was, you know, within, I'd say, over the next year. And they actually, in fairness, when they moved down, they got a lot of redevelopment money, these mob guys did. And so they didn't try to reopen an actual strip club. We're going to get into strip clubs later on because that's a big moneymaker for the mafia today.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, they tried to open up. This was kind of during the disco era, and they tried to open up really fancy high-end discos with that redevelopment money they'd gotten because they had to tear their clubs down in order to make room for a urban renewal and a new hotel downtown. And so,
what was 13th Street?
What was 12th Street, actually. 12th Street strip between Central and Wyandotte, and those were all low-end strip clubs. As one guy said, it was a place where 50-year-old whores would try to sell watered-down drinks to truck drivers. But when they moved down, they tried to start really high-end places because they had this redevelopment money from the city and the developer. The Marriott Hotel developer is probably primarily from the city. And they tried to open really high-end discos and charge a really high cover charge, and people weren't paying it. They didn't really want to hear disco music. The disco phase was just leaving, and people wanted to hear local bands, and Ebenezer's and Freddy's, Poor Freddy's, and all the other clubs, the Boiler Room and Nasty McNasty's, they had some cool names, and the Warehouse Lounge, they all had local bands of young guys and gals who had created their own band, and it wasn't a disco sound. It was, you know, some singer-songwriter. What's that band? There's one still around that still plays, River Rock, I think's the name of it. And they're still here, and they were, you know, they were people that composed their own music. There was some cover, but mainly they composed their own music. And people, young people were all in their 20s and 30s at that time, and they wanted to hear that, and the disco phase was gone, and these clubs were starting to go out of business. As these clubs went out of business and they blew up a couple places to collect the insurance on it, the whole place, it died. Within about, there was one big explosion of Pat O'Brien's and Judge Roy Bean's were a couple of those clubs. And
did they actually collect insurance on that?
Oh, yeah, they collected. The owner of that building collected $100,000 from that, and it was such a huge explosion. The images that were in the Kansas City Star the next day, it looked like Beirut or Lebanon in the 70s.
It just leveled the building.
It just leveled a block-long building. It was about a half a block wide and block long, and it just leveled that whole building. There was nothing but a hole left and bricks all over the street. And when people saw that, Chuck Haddix from the Fish Fry was working down there that night, and he said, you know, people the next day, they just didn't come back. People just did not come back to the River Key. The club started closing up because they were all opened by young people on a shoestring, and they had a low rent, and they ended up closing up. And a couple of strip clubs did open up on Delaware. One was called Delaware Daddies, and it had go-go girls and strip clubs, and it had been owned by a guy that had a place of...
over on 12th Street
over
before?
On 12th Street, yeah. I was just trying to think the name of his joint, and I can't remember it. And I kind of know his name, but I better not say it because I might be wrong. But another guy, so I'm in the intelligence unit at this point in time, and we're monitoring all this, and we're also working on the skim coming out of Las Vegas, helping the FBI do surveillances.
Do you know the guy's Bonadonna?
You know, I knew Freddie Bonadonna. I'd actually worked for him off duty down there, walking around just doing security. Back in the early 70s, before I went to the intelligence unit, I was a street policeman, and we had a really sweet off-duty job. We just go down to the River Key, myself and about three or four other guys had this, and we'd do two-man foot patrols, and we'd just walk around the River Key when it was really hopping at night and provide...
Uniform security,
and then we'd go over to Freddie's joint. Poor Freddie's at the end of the evening. He'd just get, I think it was like $50. He'd just get $50 each out of his cash register and hand us $50. That off-the-books money, you know, and we like that off-the-books money. Kind of like the tip money sometimes, and although I understand you do have to report some of that. We didn't report any of this. The statute of limitations is way up on that. This place was vacant practically down there, and Willie the Rat Camisano, his brother, Joe, who had a joint up on 12th Street, he moved a strip club in called Cotton Eye Joe's down on 3rd Street. And this other place, Delaware Daddy's, opened up, and then another place on Delaware Street, about 5th Street, is where the omelet place used to be, Papa Nick's, opened up. And we're cruising around, and we write down license numbers, and we noticed a couple of times that there's a couple of mob guys. Tuffy DeLuna was there, I believe Felix Farina was down there one night.
He had a licensed vehicle in his own name, and when he ran his plates, it came up Tuffy.
Yeah, right. At that point in time, I knew exactly what kind of car Tuffy drove, and I knew it better than my own car. I'd seen the back of it so many times from following him. And I knew, you know, Felix Farina and some of these other guys, Vince Abbott trying to think who else was down there. Some of the kind of younger mob guys were down there at this one club called the Bowery. It just had opened, so we nobody had gone in there yet.
From the
intelligence unit. We checked on the licensing, and there was a guy named Gary Huffman, I believe was his name, had got the license, and the building was supposedly owned by another mob associate. But we didn't really see any direct connection. But we start picking up tidbits, and we'd drive down through there at night, and there would be 50 cars parked around on Delaware, and nobody still had gone in there. And then I don't remember how it first came out. A source, we were kind of busy following the upper echelon mob guys at this point in time, Nick Savella and Carl Savella and Charlie Mortina and Tuffy. And Tuffy, we only saw his car down there once. He's kind of the one that alerted us that we may want to pay attention to this club. Anytime we'd see a mob guy's car at a club, we'd pay a little attention to it just to see what was going on. We were kind of preoccupied following them around because we were working on the skim coming out of Las Vegas with the FBI, and they had like 20-some wiretaps up. We started getting word from informants that this club had strippers that were furnished by the local El Forastero's motorcycle gang, and they were stripping clear down completely naked. Well, this was like 1980, 1979. You know, you just didn't do that then.
Who's El Foresto?
The strippers were provided by the El Forastero's motorcycle club.
El Forastero.
El Forastero's, and they ended up combining with the Galloping Gooses to make one Galloping Goose Motorcycle Club
here in Kansas City.
Right, and they're still they're around. I saw a bunch of them riding up north about 6 months ago up I-29.
Goose is still here.
Flying the Galloping Goose colors. El Forasteros, you've never heard of them since because they were absorbed into the Galloping Gooses, I understand. That's the motorcycle gang's M.O. is they would have girls they would provide for strippers at strip clubs, and they were their girls, their women. we go in there, we hear there this is going on, and we go in there one night, and sure enough, at this point in time, Kansas City, they were not allowed to they weren't allowed by City Orange to show their nipples, and certainly not to take their pants clear off, and these girls were doing that.
They were completely naked.
They were completely naked, and this place was hopping, and so...
Well, that explains why there was 50 cars.
Yes, and I remember there's a local politician's car down there, Alex Fazzino, one time his car was down there. He's dead now, so I can talk about him. But
you didn't know he was in the club at the time.
He was in the club. His car was parked out where everybody else's car was parked. It was in the club. He was in the club. Now, I don't think anybody went in there that night. I didn't write that license number down. I don't remember. But I did go in there. That's kind of the crux of the story. I did go in there about... We started a plan. We decided we're going to take this place down. It was operating high-wide enhanced.
Well, couldn't they get shut down for being exposing nipples? And
yeah, they could. They could. But we wanted to do it right. We wanted to get as much information as we could about the whole operation because mm-hmm. of the mob guys coming down there. Maybe we could come up with something that a little more something that could put some pressure on some mob guys, or maybe break somebody and get them to testify against a mob guy. You know, okay. It seemed like it was a mob connection, but we couldn't tell what it was, partly because it was down there next to City Market in River Key.
Well, the guy that owned the building,
and Tuffy had been down there, and some other mob guys had been down there. So we looked at it from the larger view rather than just going in and sending a vice officer in and then going over to the owner and saying, you know, I'm going to cite you for allowing this, and you got to get those girls off the stage. We wanted to make a big splash too, because by this point in time, it was all over the city. People were lined up. Everybody was talking about it, and we're hatching out a plan. And so I go down there. They send me, and I get this source of mine to kind of provide me a little cover, who is just a Square John dude, but kind of known in the clubs and the it's kind of low end strip club, 12th Street strip clubs.
That he would frequent those establishments.
He would frequent those, and he was known. And so if I was with him, I was okay.
But he knew you were...
Yeah, sure. He was my friend and my source. He was my source.
He knew you were a police officer.
Sure, he knew I was
they
an officer.
Didn't.
Yeah, no, they didn't. And I wanted him to kind of help keep them from knowing I was a police officer. So we go down there. Joe was his name. We go down there one night, and there's a line. Aaron, there's a line about a block long to get in this place. We dutifully get in line, and we get up front. And this guy, this Gary, ran this place. He was the dumbest idiot he was just stupid. He did not charge, no, wait a minute, I'll take that back. He charged $1 cover charge. These guys would have paid $5 easily. It could have easily gotten $5 a person out of this because they had heard the stories. There was already stories going around how they were going to have a donkey show. Now, we've all heard of a donkey show, and if you haven't, you've never been to Tijuana, but, you know, purportedly in Tijuana they have
a live sex act with a donkey
and a woman. So purportedly they're going to have a donkey show.
They weren't going to make it with a horse before the American Royal.
Well, they probably should have. It's Kansas City. We're in line and
for the donkey show.
For the get in. We want to see what's inside. Okay. So and this guy's only charging $1. And I get up the front door and he had this line that he said he was not the sharpest tool in the toolbox. We get up there and he's asking each person, "Are you law enforcement or affiliated with any law enforcement?" Of course, we say no. You know, you don't have to answer. You don't have to tell the truth. He believes the old myth out there that there is among some uneducated, myth-believing drug people that if you ask an undercover policeman if he's a police officer, then he has to answer truthfully. And if he doesn't, then nothing in any evidence he obtains after he lies to you is not admissible. But that's wrong.
That's not true.
That's not true. So we, of course, say no, and we go in, and there's this huge crowd, and girls are dancing up on the stage, and back in the corner, kind of reconnoiter around and walk all around the place, and there's one table back up in the corner, kind of isolated from everybody, and there's all these bikers, about 5 bikers sitting there, and the girls, when they come off the stage, they walk back up there and sit with these bikers. And then another one go down on stage, and they were stripping all the way down. Joe and I, we hang out at the bar and just watch and see what happens, and the strippers come and go. And
now, even though you're undercover, can you, because this is a, you know, you can tip the girls. Yeah, you can actually get a lap dance.
You could. Well, you know, this was before lap dancing.
Okay, if you're undercover, can you really?
Well,
could you accept a lap dance?
Well, sure, you can accept a lap dance. You just don't do what they call over the hill. You don't go over the hill. You know what going over the hill means for an undercover vice guy when he's working a horse?
Over the hill?
Over the hill. You can't go over the hill.
Over the hill would be...
if you consummate the sex act with the prostitute, that's going over the hill.
That's over the hill.
That's a no-no. You're not supposed to let them touch you, actually. But that probably may have happened a time or two. And there might have been a time or two a guy went over the hill.
You can't be too jumpy. That just would make it really odd.
And so,
you're just there. You're having some drinks. You're watching the show.
And I never forget, Aaron, and this is what really fired up the upper management on the police department. I'll never forget this one as long as I live. I look up at the end of the bar, and there's a man and a woman, a nice-looking 20-something couple.
Mm-hmm.
And they start to leave, and they're totally out of place, especially this woman with this guy. They're totally everybody. There's nothing but a bunch of men in there, kind of construction worker types,
and then the biker girls,
and bikers, and middle management types, and you know, kind of Ford employee types, or you know, city hall employee types off duty, like myself and my friend, and this couple, as they're walking out, they holler at the owner and say, not ask him to come over. So they're standing at the front door and they start talking. They engage in this really close conversation. And all of a sudden he slaps his hands and he says, okay. The owner. He says, okay. And they turn around, they walk back up to the end of the bar, and the owner yells over to the bartender. He says, set 5 shots up down there. Bartender pours out 5 shots, takes him down there. That girl who's with this guy, she stands there and she slings down. I think she did 4 of them and the guy did 1. They did the shots, and then the dancer who's dancing, she gets done. And this place is packed, Aaron. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is wall-to-wall
people.
Now. Yes, we could have got them on a fire code right then. And the lights are down, and there's just a light on the stage. It's getting late at night, and this couple gets up on stage, and they start the music, and they start dancing, and they start stripping. And so the crowd starts going, live fucking. We're not going out on the air, so we can say this, right?
It's just a podcast, right?
Yeah,
it's broadcasting
a
on the radio.
Right.
Not an FCC violation.
Not an FCC violation. I'm such a rule follower, but... I will edit this out if I choose. I'll wait and see.
But the whole crowd is yelling this.
You need to hear this. It was scary, man. It was scary. These dudes are like in another world. They're drunk and crowded all up on that stage. They're only about 2 feet, 3 feet from the couple. And they're dancing and stripping their clothes off. And then the guy gets in between the legs of the girl, and he's humping away. And finally, I can't see because I'm back over at the bar. You can just see between the heads.
As far as you know.
The men, you know.
You're telling people.
I'm back at the bar.
The crowd surged forward and you went for a drink.
I was in the bathroom when that happened, sir.
But they were actually fornicating.
Fornicating. At least that's what it appeared from back here. Well, mm-hmm. I don't think they were. It was more like...
Simulated.
But they did have all their clothes off.
I couldn't tell if there was actual penetration. But that's completely outside of the scope of
law. Right. And I don't think there was. And I'll tell you why. Because I remember that one of the loudest mouths, redheaded guy, standing up close... Who was yelling louder than anybody, live fucking. It was creepy and scary. And when they get done, the music goes off, and they're going over to get their money because that was a deal. The owner had made a deal with them to give them a certain amount of money. I couldn't mm-hmm. tell what it was, but he handed them a wad of cash when they came off the stage. This guy, he starts yelling at the dude who's up on the stage. He said, man, you weren't even hard. And that guy turns to this redheaded guy, and he says, man, he says, you get up here and try this. And the redheaded guy just shut up.
No, he didn't. Was he volunteering his wife as well? Or his
date? Well, he probably was. I think he knew that it was kind of hard to keep, to get and maintain an erection standing in front of a crowd of about 50 men screaming, live fucking, I don't know, but... Anyhow, and so
You're watching all this.
We're watching all this, and they go get their money, and they leave. So I go back to the unit that night and
write up a report.
Write up a report. And, boy, when that report hit the upper management the next day, the shit hit the fan. They said, we have got to shut this place down. So they get...
So there was no donkey, though.
There was no donkey that night. The next, this was...
How long did you stay there? I mean, what would be if you're I'm undercover. Let me stay here for 8 or 10 hours.
Well, I was there about 3 hours. I had to...
Scope the whole thing out.
Scope the whole thing out, nurse my drinks along. But I can't remember. I would say that I was there, too, more than likely. It probably gets kind of boring after a while, but... This is like a Wednesday night, and so the next Saturday night, they figured that's going to be a big night because the word is, I think even the mayor had heard about this thing by then. They've got this really risque show going down in the River Key, and we get a tax squad, and we get another squad of guys from the white-collar crime squad, and then one of my intelligence squads, but the other six were off following mob guys and myself and a few other guys. We set up a van to take pictures. We got a night scope to take pictures.
Did you have like a bus because you were going to make arrests and there's going to be a lot of people?
Yes, yes. We were going to make a big splash. We didn't know exactly how many we were going to arrest, but we probably didn't have a bus ready, but we had a couple 3 paddy wagons already. And so we had a staging point, and I went down over at headquarters, I guess, because it's close to downtown. And so my job was to go back over and hit some of the other River Key bars, Joe Camisano's place, and... just Delaware Daddies in particular. I think that's all was there. And just kind of hang out and make sure there wasn't any buzz that the word hadn't got out or see what was going on and just get a feel for the area. And so I started that about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I started drinking about 5 o'clock that afternoon and then go back about an hour and a half later and say, it's just cool as a cucumber down there. And they're starting to – it was about 7 o'clock by then. I said, they're starting to line up at the Bowery was the name of it. They're starting to line up at the Bowery. And I ended up getting in the surveillance van for a little bit and going down there with a guy and sitting there to kind of help identify, see if there's any mob guys that went in. We wanted to be able to tell. We were going to send some undercover vice officers in, about 8 of them, probably TAC and vice, too, and maybe white-collar crime. We had about 8 undercovers we were going to send in to try to spot who was doing what. Like, we wanted to grab all the motorcycle gang guys right away. And if they tried to melt into the crowd, be able to point them out, say, when the TAC guys came in their uniforms, say, hey, grab that guy and pull him over here. We wanted to get all the motorcycle gang guys' names. We wanted to get all the names of the gals. And there would be a few arrests. There would at least be arrest of the gals that were stripping, and there'd be arrest of the owner.
And anybody had, say, weapons?
And anybody had any weapons, exactly.
So, but these 8 guys that were undercover, they had to get in line.
They had to get in line. They had to go in there and hang out a little bit. They didn't get to see the show I did, though. I know that. They didn't have that show.
Did they have like a radio on them so they knew what was going on outside? Or we're going to come in at 10 and they're going, just hold on a few more minutes.
We had a prearranged. I think one of them was going to come back out and kind of give a high sign.
That
they had seen at least a couple, 3 girls take all their clothes off. That was the key. We needed the vice guys who were going to go to court then to be able to testify. They saw so many certain girls take all their clothes off. And kind of got around and figure out who was who. And they're in there doing that, and I'm out in the van. And I look up, and in the line, there's this off-duty policeman I know, and I know him really well. And he really, I know this guy, and he was a detective, and he really was going down to see what all the hubbub was about.
He wasn't in the tactical unit.
No, he was that kind of guy, though, that he would get out. If he'd hear about something going on, he would get out and find out about it. He goes down, and I slip out of the surveillance van, and this is poor cell phones, and run down to payphone and call the major back at the command post. I say, hey. I'm not going to give his name because he's still around. But I said, hey, so-and-so just went in there. What do you want me to do? I said, I'm not known in there, but yet known but not known. I can just slip in there and say, hey, get out of there. I'll never forget the major says, I just leave him in there. And so I don't know quite what he would do. I think it was just that, he could just stay in there and we're going to do our thing anyhow. Well, by 10 o'clock, we were getting ready to raid the place, and the off-duty policeman had left. He'd gone in and checked it out. And
fortunately, he had exited the building.
Yeah, he had exited the building anyhow. And we go in, and then my job was to then go in and just as they go in to do the raid, I'm going to be walking in and just order a beer up at the bar and just hang out just to see what, because they want me in there so when it's all done to see what happens, what the owner does.
So once the raid happens,
the
guys that are actually undercover in there are going to participate in the raid.
Right.
But you're supposed to kind of stand back and be like, let everybody by, and they kind of let you.
They don't pay attention to
yeah,
me.
Yeah, they leave you alone.
And then so they take the girls off. I think they took a couple of the bikers off that had some kind of weapons on them. I think they got another gun off of somebody.
How many officers came through the door then?
Oh, there must have been about 10. It was a huge deal.
I mean, how do they come up to the doorway without somebody, the guy at the door, the same guy that let you in days before?
Yeah, well,
was it the same guy? Did when the officers came up, are you an officer?
No, by then the line's down.
Okay.
And so the show's going. There's a few people maybe coming and going by now. The place is jam-packed full, but there's no more line. So they just came down Delaware Street.
Like they just pulled up in vehicles
and parked
out
front and jumped out and ran in. And you know, there was really not time for anybody to react inside. And ran in, just get the place quiet, because you got a bunch of drunks in there. And every once in a while, somebody wants to fight the police. And so you just kind of get everybody calmed down and have this big presence. And the bikers calm down and grab the girls, have the undercover vice guys point out the girls and then point out the guys that they would go talk to right afterwards. And so the owner, and they didn't take him out that night. And so I'm hanging out in there and drinking, and there's a few people left. They don't close it down. Intentionally, they did not say everybody has to leave, you're closed.
Yeah.
So they want, because we wanted to see what this guy did, who he talked to, if he got on the phone, if anybody came down, if he's trying to pull any strings. We've seen a politician down there. We've seen some mob guys down there. And he...
Did you leave some girls that were dancers there, too, then?
No, all the girls were gone.
Okay.
Yeah, there was no dancing. There really was about 15 men in there drinking.
Just having beer at that point. Like, whew, we didn't get arrested.
Right, right. So I hang out for about another hour in there just drinking and watching. And the owner, he's walking around, he's fuming. He's madder than hell, and he keeps saying, you know, I've talked to the captain. You know, the captain knows this isn't supposed to happen. I'm going to call him down here. Well, pretty soon the Central Patrol captain shows up, who is, first you might think, well, what's he paying somebody off here? But no, the Central Patrol captain was Mr. Square John.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Square John from day one, but the owner, Gary, did get on the phone and call down there and get the captain on the phone and start complaining about this raid on his place. So
the captain came down.
Captain Palmer came down and said, "Well, what the heck's going on?" You know, but there was.
Did he recognize
like
you sitting there, or did you stay for that?
I did, and he may or may not have. He may not have seen me. I don't remember, but Palmer was cool enough; he wouldn't have said anything. And he just went down and he listened to the guy complain about the police. Police brutality and police, you know, overreaching of power and how they raided his place and all that. And then he turns around and leaves and goes back. And so I leave. And Aaron, by this time, I probably over-imbibed a few times when I was working undercover, because it's kind of, I don't know, it's
you got to stay in character.
You got to stay in character. That's what we used to say. And I drove back down to the office. We're down at, you know where Motti's Coffee Shop is?
Mm-mm.
It's down about 18th and Wyandotte, 19th and Wyandotte. There's in the film district. At that point in time, it was a bunch of old buildings and inexpensive rental, and we had a big undercover office down there. And I drove down there, and when I got there, I was drunk. I didn't even realize how drunk I was, because I parked almost in the middle of the street, and my sergeant looks out when I walk in. He just kind of glances out the window. He said, "Jinx, are you okay?" I said, "Well, yeah, sure. Sarge, I'm all right." He calls some other guy over. He said, "Here," he said, "you drive him home tonight." That was pretty much the end of it. That guy...
Well, after they did the raid on that...
That night, they...
Strip club.
Came back...
There were other strip clubs there in the River Key.
Right, right. But they were not...
They were not as... They were much more tame.
Right. They were just your normal kind of strip club that had been operating for a long time, and the girls would always have pasties and a G-string on and kind of dance, and there was no touching of the customers back there. There was no lap dancing. Mm-hmm. There was verboten to touch the customers, and the customers touch them. They may go... sit at the bar, and a customer might buy him a drink.
Sure.
But
That was the point where they was buying watered down drinks for 50-year-old whores.
Exactly. So this guy, the business dropped way off because we had a big splash in the newspaper, and the word went around. You know, people who went there said, "Oh God, you hear about? There's like 500 policemen down here, and they arrested half the place." Of course, that didn't happen, but you know how stories go. And the business just dropped to nothing. And you know, within about a month, that place just closed down, and we never heard of that guy again.
Which guy was it? The owner, or because the guy that was on the lease?
The guy was on the lease and was managing and running the place. He just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
We had not seen him before, and in the intelligence unit, we keep track of guys who, you know, are mob
show
associates
up or make,
and have connection with mob guys. And we had never really heard of him before. As we checked in his background, he'd been a used car salesman somewhere over in Independence. And, you know, when he closed that place down a month or so later, why, because he didn't have any business and he couldn't keep it open, why, he just drifted back into the background. Mm-hmm. We never saw him again.
Never saw him again.
So it was a lot of fun, and, we all lived happily ever after. I don't know if he did or not, but we sure did.
Well, you were fortunate in that when the police came in and actually raided the club, that there wasn't any city councilman.
Oh, that's what we were hoping for.
You were hoping for that?
We were hoping for a city councilman. We wanted to make some headlines, or at least a state representative. Fazino had been in there before. That would have been good that night. We would have called the newspapers as soon as we got out of there, even though he wasn't arrested. We worked really hard to catch dirty politicians out of my squad. We worked extra hard at it, and we never really did. Our local politicians, they have been dirty in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we had one city councilman who ended up getting indicted for taking some money. God, I shouldn't even start this story.
You might save it.
I'll save that story.
Did you actually end up?
I got to know him.
Busting him?
Well, the FBI did. I got to know him. He worked a game on us trying to get into our unit, and I was assigned to be his liaison for a while, and then they had.
Was he trying to get into your unit so he could get some of the intelligence that you had gathered?
He wanted to know if anybody was watching him, and he knew being in city government, we would kind of work with him a little bit, and so he made up a story. But that's time for another story. And I hope you like that story. It's another day in the exciting life of a Kansas City Police undercover officer.
And of course, you can download Gary Jenkins' app.
Correct. On
Kansas
iTunes,
City Mob Tours.
Kansas City Mob Tour, and the Android Google Play Store and iTunes Store. And I'd like for you to go and subscribe to my podcast on the iTunes Store and give me a review. I don't know if I've got any reviews yet.
We've got 6-7 episodes up from the first series.
Correct.
We've recorded another 2- or 3-part series.
Right. We have a 3-part
on the Ku Klux Klan.
Correct. You'll find that story interesting on the Ku Klux Klan. It's a little slice of life that most people don't know about, but it's out there.
I'm surprised they don't, did they get into the taping when they did the episode on the public access station?
Did they get into the taping?
Did you guys end up busting them, or they scattered before they actually got taping?
They taped one show.
I would be curious if that's somewhere in the archives, there must be that episode. Not that
somebody's got it. And when I talked to my friend Leonard, who has the Klan undercover organization, and I mean anti-Klan undercover organization. He has all kinds of intelligence he's gathered over the years, and he had pictures of all those guys. That night, we had taken pictures of them. I gave copies of them to Leonard, but he did not have the copy of that VHS tape. And we had it at my unit back then, but it's been so long now that it got destroyed.
Things get destroyed.
Yeah, see, in the intelligence units, we put some rules on ourselves before the government did. And if you gather, if I see your license plate, Aaron, for example, if you're hanging out at a mob place, which you've been known to do, we probably had your license plate.
Not intentionally.
Down there. And we write your license plate number down, and we file it, saying, you know, this guy is a regular.
He works at one of those places.
He works there. That's important because, you know, you may stumble and you may have a case, and then we'll go say, hey, we can handle this DUI or this traffic ticket for you, Mr. Gnerk, if you are our eyes and ears inside this place where you work. I've done that many a time.
Yeah, I think Vince, in the words of Vince, you want to snitch.
Yes. After 5 years, if that's a one-time entry and you don't come back into our view in the intelligence unit, after 5 years, they'll purge you. And when they
still do that today in terms of the intelligence units
here
in town?
Right, right. The local police is part of the National Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit's guidelines. And this all came out of the Watergate stuff. There's a lot of crackdown on intelligence gathering in the 1970s after Watergate. So they decided to have more stringent regulations than the feds were putting on any kind of intelligence gathering outfit. And so we just decided we would review our files. And if there was no kind of ongoing criminal activity that we could prove on somebody, we would destroy it so there would be no record. So, like the Klan guys, they never really came back to town. They all disappeared. They just drifted away. Who knows?
Well, but they may be in an intelligence unit in some other city. You wouldn't necessarily know that.
Well, but Mahon was down in Oklahoma. He moved to Catoosa, and his twin brother moved to Catoosa, Oklahoma. He ended up, just went to jail for bombing a diversity director down in Scottsdale. So, yeah, they didn't quit. They just moved out of Kansas City.
Yeah.
So, until
next time, be safe.
And sleep tight, knowing that the Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit is out there following you around. Well, not really.
Not me.
Following the bad guys around. Good night.
I hope I'm not one of the bad guys.
You're not.
Good night. Well, I don't know. Depends on who you ask.
Our new opening and closing music was provided by Automatic, an electro-punk rock group out of Liberty, Missouri. Check them out on Facebook.